Hello and welcome to the Reborn Music Business Worldwide podcast, supported by Sound Exchange, who, as you may have read in a recent MBW article, have paid out more than $4 billion in performance royalties to artists and rights holders to date. Our first guest for this run of the podcast is somebody who knows exactly what it takes to break globally successful artists time and time again. Mike Caron has been a part of Atlantic and Warner Music for more than 20 years, after joining the company's Big Beat Records aged 17 in the mid-90s. Today, Mike is Creative Officer of Warner Music Group Worldwide, having signed or worked with artists such as Trey Songz, Flo Rida, Wiz Khalifa and Bruno Mars. He is the founder of Artist Partners Group, which hit headlines earlier this year for being the only label to break a debut artist's album to gold in the first 6 months of 2016 in the US. In fact, it did it twice, with Nine Track Mind from Charlie Puth and Isla from Kevin Gates. I asked him all about the A&R process, working with difficult artists, the philosophy of APG, and what the music business itself is getting wrong in 2016.
What is it about APG that's leading to that frequency of success when perhaps others are struggling?
So first, we believe everything starts with the music. We want to provide every artist with more resources than their competition. We want to reinforce the idea that they have as much creative freedom as any artist has, that they are encouraged to release a lot of content, and that we'll be relentless about the best of that content and make sure it gets heard. Everyone has their own definition of what a star is, but you know, we sort of believe that if you are a star, you still have to work, essentially harder than all of your competition. And our artists, we don't sign them if they don't have that.
Am I right in thinking that you're not just an A&R executive, you songwriter and producer in your own right, and that your contributions have appeared on records from Beyonce, Kanye, David Guetta, and others? And if so, what impact do you think that has on your approach to A&R itself?
Yeah, we have that with a lot of our A&Rs were DJs, producers, songwriters. They were artists. They were bloggers or playlisters. And we sort of demystify the studio process. I have Pro Tools classes for anyone who wants them. And people are encouraged to experiment. I think the biggest learning for me was the idea that there's no such thing as a good or bad idea, and there's no real qualification for being a producer or songwriter. You know, essentially everybody is a producer and everybody is a songwriter unless they convince themselves otherwise. You know, many are not very good, but the ones that are very good had to get there through, you know, day one, experimenting and then continuing to dedicate their time and focus and thoughts to evolving. So with that respect, I think being a producer and writer, I've realized that there's no one way or rule to making a great record. The records that I've been a part of, some of them started from scratch with me in my bedroom experimenting, and some, I came in the ladder with sort of fresh ears and an idea of how to change something significantly that it would make a major difference in the song. And that just keeps, you know, your imagination open for every session, looking at it, not like, here's the rules to how we approach this. There really are no rules. I hate the word rules. It's like sort of the antithesis of A&R.
You obviously have a long history in A&R before APG. You know, worked with Trey Songz to Wiz Khalifa and CeeLo Green, Bruno Mars, Ed Sheeran. Spent 20 years, which we'll come back to, or there or thereabouts, as part of the Atlantic family. In all of that time, what are the most important lessons that you've learned?
Other than the fact that there are no rules on how to make a record, I think the most important one is that when you're looking at talent, you're looking at a constantly moving target, meaning you discover an artist that they're 17, 18, 19 years old, they're in a certain mind state, they're at a certain place of abilities and experience, and if they're not ready or you're not ready for them at the particular time, 6, 12, 18 months go by, and that person has gone from being 17 to 19. They're a different person, and you have to view them differently. You have to understand that their life experiences, that their, you know, hard work and dedication makes them, you know, that their experimentation, everything makes them a different person, and you have to see them with new eyes. And you may have to do that again another year and a half or two more years later. And we have a tendency as organized human beings to make a list and scratch them off. Oh, I've seen that person. He is or she is X, Y, Z. And then ignore them in the future. And we're not talking about, you know, binary objects. We're talking about human beings that are constantly evolving and changing. And to see every creative body as a new person every 18 months takes is a tough lesson, and you have to constantly remind yourself of it. The other lesson I would say is that you know, music doesn't get old until it's on the radio. Meaning, like, the clock starts ticking when it's on the radio and people are hearing it every day, and they've, you know, sort of, it's kind of hard to go to radio a second time or to go back in time and pretend it didn't happen. But, you know, if you look at Empire of the Sun or Capital City Safe and Sound or Ed Sheeran A-Team, songs that took years and years to break, and so many of those are the list that actually records that ended up happening. But there's so many where people looked at and said, that song is old. It's been out for a year. It's been out for 2 years. It's an old song. Let's move. You know, it didn't work. And they give up. And great music is never gets old. And you can keep revisiting it. And labels, I think, constantly give up just when they're on the precipice of making something happen. Mm-hmm. And we have to sort of get over the, you know, always new mentality.
I was just thinking, as you were saying about human beings evolving as you work with them, how do you deal with it when you don't get on with an artist, don't like an artist personally, but you think they're fantastic, even if you start working with them and you like them at 17, but you don't like them at 19? Use your example.
I mean, that's tricky. I'm always looking for that magic artist who I love, listen to their music personally. I like them as a human being, and I believe the general public will see their talent and love their music as well. It's sort of the hat trick of artists, and I'm lucky to have some of those artists, which is just makes me want to go to work every day. You know, as far as, you know, the artists that are sort of more difficult to work with or going through rough periods in their life, having done this and stayed doing A&R for so many years, you see cycles. You see artists that have, you know, going through transformational periods in their life where they're facing a lot of challenges. They're facing issues that they're trying to work out, and they go through hard times, and they sometimes make life hard on you. And I've been doing this long enough where I've seen people come to the other end and grow from it and apologize and become even better people, like, you know, sort of counter it in the long term. And usually the ones that don't, that are always difficult for their careers don't go very far. Ultimately this business is so much about motivating people, and it's not just, you know, not motivating press or radio promo, although that is important, but motivating the members of your band to give it their all, motivating your collaborators in the studio, motivating you know, your manager, because usually your manager is, if they're good, they're not only managing you. So I think those problems generally work themselves out if you have patience.
Who have been the biggest mentors of your career, and what lessons did they pass on to you?
So, I met Craig Hellman when I was 17, and he pretty immediately offered me a job doing marketing for Big B Records and Atlantic, doing hip hop marketing, and you know, there's been no longer mentor than Craig. I've been working either for him or with him for 21 years, and he really taught me so much about how the music business is about the music, essentially. And it's about the artist, the voice, the personality, and the bar. And really, the most important thing I learned from him is probably patience, and you know, giving an artist time to figure out what they need to figure out, and not being afraid to go back on mixes or productions and live with them and then revisit them again. And just have that sort of pursuit of excellence, and I thank him for it.
Is there anyone else who comes to mind who's been a mentor? Obviously, Craig's been with you on the journey since you came into the Atlantic family.
So Craig's been so long with Craig that he's stands out as the first. I feel like I get every year I have another mentor, and sometimes my mentors are people that have had more experience, and sometimes it's people who have less experience. I'm learning from almost the innocence of young people going into the business, and now in A&R it's there's more people who've had less time in the business to learn from. Because there's just fewer, more experienced people. But I'll feel like I even was this mentor and influence from a single meeting. I had a meeting with T.I. and Rick Rubin a couple of years ago. And, God, it was probably more than a couple of years ago. And I'm sure Rick Rubin's got, tons of skills. But just sitting through that one meeting with watching his, relentlessness to hear every single piece of music that T.I. had available, every song, every freestyle, every half idea, every hum, when he had gone through, exhausted probably 80 or 90 ideas, he asked if there were, notebooks or books of poetry or voice notes or anything else left. Like I was, an archaeologist with a relentless pursuit to finding those bones, literally, the bones of a song or the bones of a great idea. And that was a single meeting. And, I feel like I was, mentored by Rick and I barely know the guy. And those moments are I could list a thousand of them. I was always, really, I'd share this to young artists all the time. And music business is a crazy, crazy business where you can go in the studio with a producer, writer, artist, and most of them will just let you sit on the couch in the back of the room and watch them work. And you try not to say anything and interrupt their flow, because they're actually they're showing you all this magic. They're showing you their technique. They're not usually guarding their process. And you can learn so much. And in most other businesses, they would, keep you far away and not want to show you any of their secrets. It's really unbelievable, and it's really great in that way.
We talked before about overcoming a personality clash or an artist going through a rough patch and that manifesting itself in their actions. Which artist has tested you the most and taught you the most about yourself?
Taught me the most about myself. Huh. That's kind of deep. I would say, I don't know if I could come up with a single thing, but there was plenty of moments with different artists where they inspired me or surprised me in ways. Ed Sheeran sort of long-term, from being such a young guy, he had everything planned out. He had so many ideas. He was so determined, and he knew how he was going to get, everywhere. He had five albums named and planned. He had, a mission and confidence and all of these things. And watching, it constantly amazes me when I see very young artists become leaders, because they have an entire team. They have these you know, managers and agents and lawyers and band members and producers and writers, and they have this sort of whole universe that swirls around them. And some of them can just get tugged by that universe in different directions, and some of them really, probably the more successful ones, become natural leaders of that entire ecosphere. And I've seen a lot of, you know, in different ways, from Trey Songz to Wiz to definitely to T.I., Ed Sheeran to Bruno Mars. They all did that. They were all sort of leaders of their extended partners. And every time I see that, especially from someone who's, you know, barely 21, it blows my mind.
When discussions around A&R like this come up, it's very tempting to ask you about all of the successes and all the great artists you work with. But that sort of shows the lie to the idea that there's not a downside to A&R. And when something hasn't quite worked, or the vision you had for it hasn't come off, often you'll end up dropping an artist. We've seen that, you know, everyone in the business probably knows the likelihood of A&R success is pretty slim. I mean, how do you go about dropping an artist?
Yeah. So I'll start that by saying the part of the business that gives me most pleasure and that I focus on is breaking new artists and new writers and watching them have their first hit, you know, song on the internet, their first hit of radio, their first sold-out show, their first you know, sold out tour, you know, all of those things, their first awards, they're coming, the second, coming back from that, what's, you know, always the challenge, just beating the sophomore slump, all of those things. So, you know, when it's not working, it's very frustrating, and you're not doing, you know, you're unable to deliver the dream to the artist. It's definitely an emotional thing, because it's, for me, it's my entire purpose. The other side, it's not the end of the road. You know, most of the artists that I've signed have been, I'd say more than half of the successful artists I've signed have been dropped by other labels. If you look at Ed Sheeran and Bruno Mars and Wiz and T.I. and all, you know, so many artists were on other labels before we signed them. And so if you are the first signing an artist to their first record deal and it isn't working, you know, they've tried everything. You've tried everything, and it's just not yin and yang. That's so important. It isn't the chemistry needed to get something over the hump. Then, you want them to be out of the deal, and you want them to know that to want to be out of the deal, because there's another chance for success for them. There's a lesson to be learned from both parties. There's a new, fresh approach to be tackled, and the potential for success, knowing how many artists didn't figure it out the first go-round and sort of reposition themselves for the second. So I always approach it, and this is actually something Lior passed, which is if you find yourself in a position where you have to drop an artist, you want to root for them. You want to make it as smooth as possible. You want to be there to support them in the future. You want to legitimately hope that they are successful, and even help if you can. You know, I think so much of the industry, some of the most problematic parts of the industry are those people that believe that other people's failures are their success, and their, you know, their ego it wants them to, you know, something not to work if they're not involved. But that's just, it's just the wrong mentality. And I think we owe it to every artist that gives us a chance and trusts us that we do our best to make them successful, even if that means supporting them in another situation.
Do you think that attitude that you've just espoused there actually helps you be successful in terms of you not thinking too much about the competition and not wishing their market share to go down and not wishing their signings to fail?
Yeah, I do the opposite. I'm rooting for the success of the industry. I don't look at us as competing against one another as much as I look at us competing against video games and apps and movies and just people's time and attention. I think innovation by other labels, when you innovate, you other people innovate, you learn, and everyone's studying each other. And if we can, you know, bring young teenagers and tweens into music, then it benefits everybody. You know, the other thing, and going back to the signing, and this is one of my revelations, on one side, if it's not working, you don't want to eat the person's career, and you want them to be successful, and you don't want to hold them up. On the other side, I think people are unrealistic about the amount of time it takes to be successful, and very few people have really studied the business to understand that the timeline that people have in their head of, you know, signing and being successful in 12 to 18 months is unrealistic, and possibly the reason why a lot of artists are, you know, successful on their second record deals is that the first team wasn't patient enough, that they discovered an artist really early that was seriously talented and just needed time to gig and needed time to write and develop their writing skills and to find their collaborators and to build a fan base. And that internal cycle that people have of 12 to 18 months for a brand new artist that doesn't have a fan base is probably unrealistic. And that the real timeline is somewhere, you know, 2 years plus. And, you know, advances and are going to burn out before then. And they're going to need, you know, a business model, a living business model that's going to last more than 2 years to survive, to make it to that point.
It is unrealistic, but it's also pretty epidemic, particularly in the, and I'm not pointing any fingers here, but in certain elements of the major label world, particularly the, I suppose you could say the pop-leaning side of the major label world. Do you think that attitude needs to change if the industry is going to be more successful together?
Yeah, I mean, you have a lot of, you know, ticking clocks when an artist gets signed. You know, a lot of times you have a manager who's really banking on that artist being successful and that income, you know, covering that manager's costs. Mm-hmm. You have an artist who is maybe, you know, supporting himself, maybe supporting he or she's supporting other people, and they're expecting to, you know, their advance only to last, you know, to need to last 6 months or a year, and they're counting on, you know, touring income or other performance income or royalties kicking in by that second year. And you have an A&R person who's generally on like a 3-year contract who's, you know, maybe a year and a half into that, and he's looking for a success, you know, before his contract ends. So you have all these people that are sort of, you know, you want the urgency, and you want it to, and of course everybody wants success as fast as they can have it. But you can't really, you know, hyper, you know, speed a someone's human evolution, like, and plus the ability to, you know, go out and touch fan after fan after fan. It's unless you're, of course, you know, want to think you're going to go immediately to radio, but going to immediately to radio with no fans is really a get rich quick scheme, and we know how most of those, you know, turn out.
What is the proudest moment of your career so far, over the, you know, the 20 plus years that you've been doing it? What really stands out?
I mean, I see the proud moments evolve. I mean, when I developed Nappy Roots from a, you know, local college band to when they were Grammy nominations that morning. I remember hearing that Grammy nominations and being really proud and excited. But then that was trumped in 2010 after John Janik and I had relaunched Elektra, and with Bruno and CeeLo and Ed Sheeran and the HBO soundtracks. And I think we wound up with like 8 or 9 nominations and like in some of the best categories. That was a whole other level. But it's probably, I feel, you know, in the anniversary of sort of our third year with Artist Partners, having the only, you know, platinum new act and the only 2 gold new acts of the year. I mean, I think that's sort of beating that 2010 Grammy moment in my mind.
What's the biggest regret from your career, and what did you learn from it?
The biggest regrets were, definitely connected to every artist that I wish I signed, that I didn't. Some being, didn't negotiate the deal as aggressively as I should have. Some had to do with letting sort of unimportant factors cloud the judgment. And some I quite frankly didn't hear fast enough or early enough. And you're always replaying that in your mind how you would see it differently. But whenever it happens, it's never happened in isolation where the only thing that's going on is this is this act and your decision on that act or how much time you're going to dedicate towards working on it. There's always a fury of 20 different things going on, and how they're all how every decision's affecting one another. It's always the music. It's always the act. There isn't a decision with any of the artists I worked with that I regret, because both the A&R and the artists and the management, we learn from every decision. So every bad decision leads to a better decision next, and some of the best decisions wouldn't have been made without mistakes along the way to learn from. So I regret none of them.
Just on the Elektra point, I'm just interested to know, did you have much many conversations with Jack Holtzman during that period? Did you pick up anything from Jack's experience in the industry?
I've got time with Jack, and I also, who I love and is great, and I just saw him a couple of weeks ago. He came by to see the studios. But I also had time with Amit, and you get this quality time with these incredible guys, and it all comes down to it's about the hits, dummy. It's like, it's about the artists, it's about the hits, it's about inspiring and challenging, and those are the two things. If you're constantly challenging someone, you can make them feel beat up and destroyed, and you have to equally inspire them, and those are two important things. This is there's no ones and os in the creative process. It's the moves of the greater company can inspire or crush, or demotivate an artist. And really, we're dealing with humans, and being constantly reminded of that is the most, helpful resource I can always have. The other thing about Jack and Amit that are pretty amazing, and I like drawing the similarities because they're so different, is that Amit was always curious. He always wanted to know who the next act was, where the show was. He wanted to learn about them. He had a million questions. He was interested. And Jack, the same thing. Jack's interests go beyond music. They're technology and innovation and all all of these. But they're guys that always want to learn, and they feel so young. Amit always felt so young. Rest in peace. But into his old age, and Jack still to this day just wants to learn and wants to be out there and wants to grow. And it's really so inspiring to see.
Are you confident that the recorded music business has a bright future? Are you confident things are gonna come good and continue to grow?
Yeah, I think it's going to be amazing. And the reason why I'm so confident it's going to be so amazing is there's so many flaws in it right now. There are so many mistakes and gaps and issues, and most of them are not difficult to correct. I have an internal list of things to change about the business that are all changeable, which will untap tons of growth. And there's tons of opportunity and segments that are just being ignored. And there's so much of music that is so independent and will continue to evolve, you know, with or without support. And then there's all these parts of music that the last 15 years ate up, and they're almost dormant because no one's doing them. And if somebody is aggressive and believes in the future and is willing to invest, you can start to fill the void in these untapped opportunities. I'll give you an example. One example is the boy band and the girl group, and why do, you know, boy band and girl groups don't exist right now? First is they're expensive. Instead of moving around a single body, you're moving around five body. Second is they take a long time to develop. And third is there's a lack of people that have the experience in doing them. And you have to get the experience by trying it, making a few mistakes, and getting it right as you figure out the solution. And right now you have, you know, Psycho has had some of the biggest groups in the world, or boy band and girl groups. They've done it, and it's because they've they have a significant team and have focused on that. And some people will say, well, it's about a TV show. But then you'll look at, you know, the last 5 years of American Idol in the U.S. or The Voice, and the lack of successful acts from those TV shows. So it can't just be about the TV show. It has to be about the A&R. And there's just these existing voids, that being one of 20, that clearly there's a ton of opportunity and there's a ton of demand for, but it just takes like a conscious effort and resources to enable that segment.
I suppose you might be kind enough to give us another one that plays on your mind. What's wrong with the industry that could easily fix?
We have to figure out how harness technology where the communication and the distribution in both marketing, promotion, A&R, and then sort of bringing that money back to the places where it can be reinvested as quickly as possible, and where the most important segment of the music business is those that are willing to take risk, and how money comes back to the risk centers as fast as possible and gets redeployed, because that creates the exponential growth of the business. But when it takes money so long to come back, or feedback, or the cycle of promotion, it takes that much longer till it can get redeployed. And that's something where, you know, we're seeing on some lanes music happening faster than it's ever happened before, and then in other lanes slower than it's ever happened before. And narrowing that gap and building, you know, systems for it is going to change the business entirely. And most importantly, I think more than anything, like, people buy into artists when they understand and believe in their talent. And they like their songs, but in order to become a fan and buy the tickets and buy the albums, you have to believe in an artist's talent. And I think sometimes some of the promotions and some of the time and attention we spend as record companies, it does a lot of things, but it doesn't convey the artist's talent. And to me, that's the most essential.
What in particular, just to pick up on that, what activities are not conveying the artist's talent, and conversely, what activities would convey the artist's talent well?
Well, let me say from a broad point, you know, when you see a huge first week sales of an album, right, which is rare nowadays, but when you see it, most of the people who are buying that album have not heard that album. They've maybe heard a single or two or seen something, and they know the artist's previous work. So usually the initial album sales are based on the collective work that's done in the past, not actually by the product that's about to come out, because they're buying it, you know, essentially unheard, unless they're, you know, sampling some previews. So, you know, sometimes we'll focus so much on sort of contests and syncs and advertising, like, you know, snippet based advertising and these little things to get people to pay attention to the music, or, you know, those are all sort of like short-term approaches to get people's attention, but it hardly you know, has them stick around, whereas hearing longer form content, seeing the show, you know, audiovisual content that tells a story, understanding, you know, the intent behind music. I mean, not about what they are making, but like why they made it.
We've talked a lot about artists, but I want to finish our conversation by talking about you specifically. I think you said you've been with the Atlantic Group, the Atlantic family, for 21 years. Obviously now you run a sort of autonomous organization, but still linked to Atlantic. You've had a lot of successes over that time. I'm sure jobs have come in from elsewhere. That would mean that you've turned them down and stuck with being part of this company and part of Warner. Why? Why have you spent 20-plus years at this organization and under that Atlantic banner?
Yeah, so it was very tempting. There was a lot of great opportunities, and I highly considered taking a few of them in the past. I think there at least once I packed up my office thinking I was leaving. But there are a few things that stuck with me. One was my relationship with Craig Kalman, his commitment to the company, and knowing that no matter what, there was at least one other person in the organization that would always understand, you know, my purpose and be a partner. But, you know, and then if you really look at that second, there's a lot of stability within Warner. There's, you know, Andrea Gannis, who's been with the company more than 25 years, and even Julie Greenwald has got to be 12 plus. But there's a lot of 20-year veterans at the business. And there gets to be a place that you get to, and people you've worked with for 10 plus years, where you don't have to tell them what you want because they already know. They get to know the way you think about things. You get to know the way they think about things, and you can get a lot done without having a conversation, just because you understand one another. And then I always see Warner as the, you know, to me, the most authentic music company. The most when I as a publisher have been in other offices, and so often I'm walking around in another group and there's no music coming out of offices. And I, you know, I've always felt from Atlantic and the Warner Music Group that it's, especially Atlantic, that it's filled with people who love what they do, and are sort of have a similar passion of like breaking new artists.
That's it. Big thanks go to Mike for his time and his thoughtful answers, and of course to Sound Exchange for supporting the Music Business Worldwide podcast. We'll be back next month with another great guest.